guardian.co.uk.
I always meant to write a sequel. And in fact, before Sacred Hunger was published, I had already sketched out two or three chapters of what was supposed to be, going to be, a sequel to the novel. But then in 1992, we moved to Italy, and it remained dropped for the next sort of 18 or 20 years. Then it came home to me in a way that the slave trade, that particular period, the 1760s, which was the time when the movement for abolition was gathering pace, at the same time, children were being sent to toil in the mines and factories in the Industrial Revolution. So one kind of servitude was replacing another. And that's what set me going again, really.
We're now in 1767,
yes,
which is 2 years after the end of Sacred Hunger.
That's right.
And the very kind of convulsive conclusion to that book.
That's right.
And the crew of the Liverpool Merchant were tracked down in Florida and have all been brought back to the UK, or as many of them as survived the confrontation. And they're now in prison awaiting trial for piracy. And Erasmus Kemp, who we met in the first book, wants to see them all hanged, firstly, but secondly is also pursuing an insurance case in order to recoup the value of the slaves who were jettisoned earlier on in the voyage. And you're going to read to us a bit now from the insurance case, which comes about halfway through the book.
"The captain put it to us," he said. "We was assembled below in the captain's cabin, and he put it to us fair and square, 100%. Will you tell us who was present at that meeting, in addition to Captain Thurso?" Waters asked. "There was myself, the boatswain, the carpenter, the men who represented responsibility and authority on board the ship. And you decided, taking counsel together, that the cargo would have to be jettisoned. Is that so?" 100%, sir." "Fellow, what is this way of answering?" Justice Blundell said, red-faced and irritable in his heavy wig. "You must answer yes or no." "Yes, sir, begging your pardon." "A collective decision taken by the responsible members of the crew," Waters said, addressing himself to the jury. "And on what grounds was this decision taken?" "It was taken on grounds of dire necessity. The witness will relate the circumstances. We were short of water, sir. There had been stormy weather, and one of the casks was holed unknown to us, and the water had leaked away. So there was insufficient water to go around among the crew and the slaves. Yes, sir, right in every detail. We had no choice, sir. We were still 10 days off Jamaica. We had to throw them over so as to be sure there was water enough for the crew." "No choice, your worship. Those are the key words. It was a question of life or death for the crew. And if the crew perished, who was to manage the ship? That constitutes lawful jettison, and that is the contention of the ship's owner, Mr. Erasmus Kemp, whom I have the honour of representing in this court today."
And so this really gets to the central issue of the book, doesn't it? Which is one of money, of value and worth, the worth that we place on human life.
On human life, yes.
And on property, that slaves are cargo and therefore to be jettisoned and can be lawfully jettisoned, or whether or not they're men and women and therefore have been murdered. And it's something that seems so outrageous to us reading it now. Mm. I wondered whether it had been a difficult thing to write about.
Difficult thing to write about. There was a historical precedent for it, the slave ship Zong, which something of the sort happened some 20 years later. This idea that Negroes on board were simply goods in the same way that timber might have been, or sacks of grain or anything else like that, was firmly held at the time. They had become property through the act of purchase. The humanity that they had before the act of purchase was cancelled by the act of purchase. And this was a period when property was a sacred concept almost.
And all of this book, it's a very procedural novel, it seems to me. It's taking the original book, Sacred Hunger, and almost kind of rereading it, passing over it again, going over the events of it again in great detail. But in this book, we are in courtrooms and dusty offices. You make a lot of the you know, the smog of London, the dirty windows. And then also, as you sort of briefly mentioned before, a lot of the action takes place up in County Durham in mines underground, where people are, you know, physically oppressed.
Oppressed, yes. I think this, to my mind, as writing, I think it reinforced this sense of restricted liberty, of captivity, of imprisonment, which runs through the book in one form or another. The mining people are made captive, as you say. They're sentenced to toil underground in the dark, in narrow spaces. At the same time, in the human relations in the book, there is a fear of being made captive. They had no voice. The Africans that were bought and sold had no voice. The crew had no voice. The only voice was the voice of the slave traders, the slave owners, global capitalism, which was burgeoning at the time. And I remember feeling that I would, with luck, be able to give them a voice. I mean, an invented voice, but grounded in history and social realities. And that's what I tried to do then. And in a way, it's what I'm trying to do here in this book too.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.